Thursday, 3:15, 73:08 a.m. Senate will govern urban affairs from 309. Senate Bill 508, 322, 321, 317, 318, and 423.
The local government and urban affairs will come to order. Good morning.
Your troops are here.
Yep. The agenda this morning is the first bill we're taking up is Senate Bill 508, which prohibits smoking in public meetings. And after that, we're taking up four bills that are sponsored by the Committee on Human Resources at the request of the Health Division. Those are SB 321, 322, 318, and 317. Let me ask first, is there anybody here that came to testify on Senate Bill 423 concerning vector control issues? I heard they were not coming, so we'll strike that from the agenda this morning and take it up another time. Now, after our agenda was prepared, the motion yesterday was for the Senate to convene at 10 a.m. this morning, and so we're a little bit crowded. I'm going to poll the committee to find out if they're agreeable, that if we have a lot of testimony left on these other four bills, that they'd be willing to come back after the session to meet for 45 minutes an hour, and the session will be over at about 11 o'clock. We'll find out after.
11 minutes. It's 11 minutes.
All right, Senator Stevenson on SB 508.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I am Bill Stevenson, State Senator from Multnomah County. The purpose of Senate Bill 508 is to outlaw the smoking of tobacco in any form at any meeting of any public body. Violation of the law would be punishable as a classified misdemeanor, carrying a fine of $10 for each violation. Passage of Senate Bill 508 would guarantee that all persons required or wishing to participate in public meetings could do so and not be subjected to the discomfort and health hazards caused by air pollution from tobacco smoke. There are three principal reasons why Senate Bill 508 should become law. First, it has been proven to my satisfaction from personal experience and from reading the 1972 Surgeon General's report on public exposure to air pollution from tobacco smoke that exposure of non-smokers to tobacco smoke is at least a significant discomfort which can produce respiratory symptoms, and at worst, and more likely, that such exposure is a distinct health hazard. A summary of the Surgeon General's report finds that, first, an atmosphere contaminated with tobacco smoke can contribute to the discomfort of many individuals. Second, the level of carbon monoxide, and as you'll recall, carbon monoxide is a colorless, odorless, and poisonous gas. The level of carbon monoxide attained in experiments has been shown to equal and at times exceed the legal limits for maximum air pollution permitted for ambient air quality. The presence of such levels indicates that the effect of exposure to carbon monoxide may on occasion, depending upon the length of exposure, be sufficient to be harmful to the health of an exposed person. This would be particularly significant for people who are already suffering from chronic bronchopulmonary disease and coronary heart disease. Now, there is really no longer any honest disagreement among medical scientists that cigarette smoking is deadly. Naturally, I think it's imprudent for people to smoke. But this bill is not a prohibition measure. It does not seek to stop people from smoking. If they wish to take the risk, that's their choice and it's their problem. But what Senate Bill 508 does say is that the smoker has no right, no privilege, to subject others to discomfort and health hazard merely to gratify a personal desire to smoke. Which leads me to the second reason why Senate Bill 508 should become law. A freedom of choice to breathe clean air should exist for all persons required or wishing to take part in public meetings, most of which, of course, are held in enclosed air spaces. That can only occur when it is recognized that the pre-existing condition is smoke-free air, and that for the rights of all persons to be respected, that condition must prevail. To accomplish this end, smoking should not be permitted. If necessary, a break should be held, and those wishing to smoke could leave the meeting room to do so. As chairman of a Ways and Means Subcommittee, this is the procedure that my committee follows. The third general reason for in support of Senate Bill 508 is that there is more than ample precedent for acting to restrict the tobacco source of air pollution. The principal House co-sponsor on this measure, Representative Pat Whiting, has been successful in having the House Environment and Land Use Committee prohibit smoking during their meetings. The Interstate Commerce Commission hearings do not permit smoking. Smoking is not allowed during sessions of federal or circuit courts. House and Senate galleries in our legislature are off limits to smoking. The federal Congress, the House and the Senate, ban smoking during sessions on the floor of those two bodies. Common carriers segregate smokers from non-smokers. In summary, the arguments for Senate Bill 508 are soundly based on those three areas. First, recognition of the need to prevent physical discomfort and health hazards from threatening participants in public meetings. Two, respect for the rights of all participants by recognizing the need to maintain the pre-existing condition of smoke-free air. And three, ample precedent. Mr. Chairman, I would urge that the bill be passed. If you'd like me to make the motion, I'd be happy to do so.
Are there questions of Senator Stevenson, Senator Durstead?
What constitutes a meeting, say, of the City Council? Two people?
Any?
I'm just looking at the time where two or three city councilmen decide they're going to meet at a table in a restaurant. Would this bill prohibit them from smoking if it was a pre-announced meeting? And then everybody there was a smoker. They decided they wanted to smoke. And then a policeman walked in and said, "You guys can't smoke at the city council meeting."
In the matter of public accommodations in a restaurant like that, I'm not sure. I was looking to see what, and Pat may have the answer for that question, but I would think that it would be, I think that it that would fall, I think that would fall within the definition of a meeting.
I would too. I don't smoke, but I just brought the question up.
Yeah. I assume, of course, it would be a regular, you know, meeting with, you know, no adequate notice and all this. Not just a matter of two or three people getting together informally.
And it would just, I wonder, too, about the situation, like in this room, if all of a sudden you had a committee meeting and three members of it were smoking, and then somebody walked in and they could slap you with a misdemeanor.
You're not having an executive
session. Whether it was or not.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's the purpose of the bill. Like the latter case you outlined,
but
surely would fall within the scope of the bill.
Well, let me paint the picture this way. There, the meeting, some committees have all smokers and some have none. You had, say, five senators. And it just happened to be that no public or no one else came to the meeting, or they came late, and the guy decided, well, all of us are smokers, let's smoke. Are you going to slap them with a $10 fine, each one of them, if they suddenly put them all out and somebody else walked in? Or?
If if the legislature would be in compliance with the law, that, you know, smoking would not be permitted. And I can't recall any committee that I'm on that does not have at least one non-smoker on it. The people that come to testify, many of them don't smoke. Many of the news people don't smoke. I've been contacted. Of course, they don't testify, but they prefer not to. But many news people do not smoke, and they find themselves in kind of uncomfortable situations. But yes, in my opinion, that case would be covered by the bill, and that's the intent of the bill.
Did you consider a bill going after the public room rather than the public meeting? For instance, theaters and other conveyances that go after the cubicle or the airspace that goes above the terrace, whether it's one person or 500. Did you consider that?
No, I didn't. Tell you the truth, I didn't. One concern I have about the bill is that it doesn't go far enough, and that it probably should encompass public accommodations, you know, public places like restaurants, to the extent that, not that you would prohibit it in restaurants, but that there should be sections allocated for people that wish to smoke and those that don't.
I think you're the only member of this committee that smokes at all is Senator John Murray's occasional cigar, right?
He is.
He smokes cigars.
One.
I think
when I go to Vancouver, BC, I
smoke. That's another question. Bill, would you have any objection if we downgraded the crime from a misdemeanor to a violation, which is like a civil thing? Category of criminal charges for violation. Fines would be the same. Wouldn't be a misdemeanor if you violated.
I'd be happy if you make it.
Yeah. You'd like to make it a felony.
Yes.
I think I'd agree with you, but I just...
I defer to the judgment of the attorneys. If that's appropriate, I'd have no objection to that.
Thank you. Any other questions, Senator Stevenson? Senator Weaver. The interesting part about it is the point that Senator Carson raised about the room. What's your reaction to that? Could we amend those things to include that kind of thing?
You mean any meeting in a public room? Any public meeting in a regularly designated public area? Yeah, I would think that would be acceptable.
Yeah.
As a smokeaholic, I really question the propriety of state legislation. As a smoker of many years, I know how much torture it is to sit for a long period of time in a meeting when you're accustomed to smoking and not be able to smoke. And while I certainly wouldn't challenge the authority of this committee, we're meeting it. In our wisdom, we want to prohibit smoking, but I think we probably should be able to do so. And the same thing would be true at the Troutdale City Council. The Rockwood Water Board, they want to prohibit smoking. I think they should be able to do that. They shouldn't do anything that would prevent that. On the other hand, I think there are certain things that it's they're going a little too far. It's an intolerant attitude. I feel to say that because I don't smoke now, that nobody else should either. And while you're some of the air you're going to breathe, have a little.
Absolutely not. I think that kind of a complacent, casual attitude is what we're aiming at in this bill. You may have missed the point that I mentioned, that this is not a prohibition measure. It does not try to prevent anyone from smoking if they don't want, you know, if they wish to smoke. The point is that any smoker, you know, has no right to expect you or someone else who doesn't wish to smoke to do so. And what we're talking about is public meetings where people are either required or from the standpoint of citizen participation that they wish to be there. The logic of your argument completely escapes me. I don't, using that logic, Senator Cook, you would leave it up to the Rockwood School District or the Troutdale City Government, for example, to decide what kind of traffic ordinances they want. You might well want to erase all traffic laws from the ORS. No, I don't think it's an intolerant attitude. I think it's a tolerant attitude. For too many years, the scale has been completely the other, imbalanced on the other side. The smoker has just assumed that he has a privilege to smoke. Not giving much of a damn about how it might affect people with asthma, with allergic conditions, and I think people will testify here from air pollution authorities with more adequate scientific data than I have compiled, which will indicate that there are distinct physical effects from concentrations of tobacco smoke. I don't think it goes too far. I don't think it's intolerant. I think what it seeks to establish is a balance and a mutual respect for the rights of smokers and non-smokers.
Senator Howard?
Mr. Chairman, as a man who never smoked a cigarette in his life, never smoked a pipe in my life, never smoked a cigar in my life, and I can sympathize with Bill, because I sat next to Vern, I think, in the 59th session of the legislature in the House. His pipe was a pretty strong talking point on the back end of the room. In that case, we mentioned it a couple of times, and Vern was very careful about smoking. I think that I don't think you're going to legislate on getting people to quit smoking. But I do think that if somebody feels strong enough in a committee like this committee that where nobody smokes, you certainly could be assigned to please be courteous if you're not a smoker, or put up a no smoking sign, which we have the power to do. It annoys me, as I say, I never spoke in my life, but I still feel that I have that right and other people have their rights. We aren't passing a law that nobody can take a drink. We license the product that we're talking about. The state makes money on it. But I would hope that people that do so would show the courtesy when they're around somebody to at least not do it when they're present. But I appreciate that I know what Bill's up against in sitting next to people that spoke and all.
if I might make a response, the point is that the smokers do not respect the rights of the non-smokers. Some of them do. Some of them do, but there are a great deal that do not. And I don't know what I have to do to emphasize this point, is that this is not a prohibition measure. This does not seek to stop anybody from smoking. All it seeks to do is to make it so that non-smokers don't have to smoke, and that if smokers wish to smoke, they can leave an enclosed airspace and do so. And I think that in that connection, if there is a meeting, there should be a recess. People can go outside and smoke if they wish. It is not a prohibition measure, and it is entirely appropriate for this legislature to legislate on this subject. This causes a lot of problems to a lot of people, and I think for too many years we've just assumed that, you know, things should continue as they have been, and that's not good enough.
Thank you, Bill, for your thoughtful presentation.
Thank you.
Representative Whiting.
Chairman, I want to make this talk. Testimony reminds me of a statement of an old gym teacher at Reed used to say, those who expectorate at their school should not expectorate on the floor. That reminds you of that.
I'll get it to you.
Yeah. Probably.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Committee. I'm Pat Whiting, State Representative from Washington County. I have presented you with a number of articles as well as personal letters to me from constituents around the state of Oregon, not just my county. I'm going to present a formal paper to you. I have various facts I want to propose, but before I start, I would like to point out, if you would take a look at page 2 of the bill, in reference to the various questions that were asked, please note that on line 7A, meeting means any joint convening of members of a public body to exercise or advise on the exercise of any power of government, and includes regular and special meetings, sessions, and hearings. Now, the bill specifically spells out governmental meetings, something to do with the coordinating of activity, governmental activity of the state of Oregon. I think that Bill will concur with me that, did he move? That this is somewhat of a new idea we're presenting to you. Maybe not new historically, but with the full impact that we are going to succeed because we have a good case. We have not extended it to all public meetings, theaters, etc., because that would not be feasible at this time. We don't have that kind of policing control over public bodies, especially in recreational settings. We are strictly talking about public meetings where the public must set in attendance in reference to participation in government. Just wanted to make that one point clear. And number two, this is not a prohibitive measure. As Bill stressed, it would be confining smoking to a place outside of a public enclosure. If you're within a closed room, respecting the rights of the non-smoker. First, I'm going to point out the health hazards of smoking in closed rooms. Second, the non-smoker's rights. Third, possibly one letter from a constituent. I will read it for the benefit of the audience. And fourth, a quote from Dr. Bastido. Senate Bill 508 is a bill which will prohibit smoking at any meeting of any public body that is exercising or advising government, which includes regular and special meetings as well as hearings. A public body means any group of persons meeting to exercise any legislative, executive, or administrative power in reference to governmental management in Oregon. We are sponsoring this bill because of our concern for the health of the individual who must attend a meeting within a closed room. The Department of Health, Education, and Welfare has already carried out a leadership role in the area of non-smoking by instituting a policy prohibiting smoking in conference rooms and in parts of cafeterias. According to Reader's Digest 72, September, non-smokers arise, quote unquote, in Washington, D.C., smoking is prohibited in both houses of Congress, in the Supreme Court, and most other federal courts, in federal museums and libraries. And please note, these are areas where they have some jurisdiction and some physical control over what goes on in the buildings. It has not been established in public recreation areas. According to the Oregon Tuberculosis Respiratory Disease Association, February 1973, exposure to cigarette smoke increases the heart rate and blood pressure of a non-smoker. It also pumps carbon monoxide into the bloodstream, unquote. Carbon monoxide is a poisonous gas found in tobacco smoke and can be dangerous for heart disease patients in a smoke-filled room. The carbon monoxide buildup can lower the oxygen intake to a dangerously low level if it is more than 50 parts per million. Smoke-filled rooms often range from 20 to 80 parts per million and can create a harmful concentration of secondhand smoke, the tobacco fumes from burning cigarettes. In an article of several years back, Dr. Robert Miller, then president of the Oregon Thoracic Society, said the exact physiological changes that happen to non-smokers in smoke-saturated environments were measured in experiments at Texas A&M University. The subjects were 103 children, ranging from the ages of 6 through 13. They divided the children into two groups. Group A was subjected to 30 minutes of smoke-filled room while in the enclosed room. And for 30 minutes, they were exposed to a non-smoked filled room. The second group was exposed to constant smoke for the full 60-minute duration. The researchers found that cigarette smoke, which is allowed to accumulate in a poorly ventilated room, significantly increases the heart rate, blood pressure, and poisonous gas in the blood. The effects are similar to those on the smoker himself, but on a reduced level. Recently, a team of researchers at the University of Cincinnati Medical Center reported that smoke drifting from the burning end of cigarettes, cigars, and pipes carries with it more cadmium, a metal poisonous to man, than the smoke inhaled by the smoker through the unlit end of the cigarette. Large doses of cadmium can cause acute poisoning in man. Lower doses, it has the same implication in hypertension, chronic bronchitis, and emphysema. Researchers at the Mayo Clinic have established that there are 1.5 million Americans, adults as well as children, who are sensitive to tobacco smoke and suffer occasional smoke-caused asthma attacks. These are non-smokers. About 11% of the nation's population, 22 million people, are sufficiently affected by respiratory allergies to seek medical help. These people are most seriously threatened by exposure to tobacco smoke. European investigations show the concentration of smoke in even every smoky conference hall, restaurants, railroad car compartments have determined that the concentration of nicotine in such areas range from 3 to 5.2 milligrams per cubic meter of air. A non-smoker breathing this air for 1 hour has absorbed a dosage equivalent of more than one smoked cigarette. In 8 hours of such an environment, a non-smoker could have inhaled the nicotine equivalent of 10 cigarettes. Dr. Jesse Steinfeld, Surgeon General, U.S., has pointed out that we should adopt throughout the United States a Bill of Rights for the non-smoker. This is at the federal level. He states, tobacco smoke can contribute to the discomfort of many individuals. Exposure to tobacco smoke may produce situations that may aggravate allergies in non-smokers and finally result in possible lung deterioration. Cigarette smoking is associated with higher overall death rates. Cigarette smoking is related to lung cancer. And on and on, just for the last, be it further resolved, that the smoker use discretion in not offending the non-smoker's health, fouling of the air, clothes, and personal effects of the non-smoker and smokers. And lastly, I would just like to quote something from Dr. Harold Shylock, who wrote the book, Mind If I Smoke. Dr. Shylock quoted Dr. Bastido, who is also a publisher and author. He stresses that a narcotic is a drug which produces a stupor and sleep. He also is quoted as saying that 10.5% of mental efficiency is reduced when exposed to smoking for at least 30 minutes, a 10.5 reduction in mental efficiency. His findings demonstrated a handicap in reflex responses, perception and concentration among those subjects who had smoked a cigarette immediately prior to the test. Question, and then I just want to quote one letter. Okay. Dear Mrs. Whiting, this is from Roseburg. I do not know the woman. I was so glad when I saw this in the newspaper, the article in relationship to prohibiting smoking in the Environment Committee. I was so glad when I saw this in the newspaper. I wish all smoking could be stopped in all public places of business. I can hardly believe, yet the government continues to allow it, even in our Social Security offices. There has been so much said about pollution, and still they allow it in places like this. She goes on to state that when she goes to get her Social Security check or must go to public places where she has to sit for long periods of time, she is exposed to a great deal of smoke, and it is bothersome to her as well as to other people. She has in the past attended governmental meetings. She has found that she cannot continue to attend governmental meetings because of the smoke atmosphere. This is a similar letter as in your packet there. I wish you would take a moment to look at them. If you have any questions, I'd like to answer them.
Any questions, Representative Matt, would you have any objection? I have the same question too. Well, whether it would be crime or misdemeanor violation.
What would be the
violation in the new criminal code, or the criminal code that adopted in 1971, when you created a series there's still crimes, but you don't go to jail for it. A misdemeanor, of course, you can go to jail. This one you couldn't because you don't have a fine.
What would the fine be?
Whatever you want to set.
All right. And there is another point that the bill does not speak to. I think we should be a bit more responsible as to how this would be carried out. And I would suggest if putting authority in the hands of the person who is conducting the meeting, the chairman, in case there is not a custodial member in the area to inform the people thereof, that the person responsible for the meeting would have to take on the responsibility of informing the meeting and the public that there was this kind of a restriction within the room only, and if someone wanted to smoke, to please leave the room and return thereafter. And yes, I would agree with your recommendation.
Just for the record, a violation ORS 161-565, an offense for the violation if it is so designated in the statute defining the offense, or if the offense is punishable only by fine and forfeiture, other civil penalties. Conviction of a violation does not give rise to a disability or legal disadvantage based on conviction of a crime. So if you don't go to jail and you're record.
That's fine. And also, another point, if you're wondering how would we enforce this, how would people know not to smoke if they were not so informed? You can't just exhibit all these laws on the door. Possibly, the chairman would make the ruling known publicly when the meeting starts. If that is not the case, if the chairman is not aware of it, maybe someone in the room will be aware of it. If they bring it up and it's announced, then if someone lights up a cigarette, and it's very easy to do non-thinkingly, then they're warned, please do not smoke. Maybe language should be in here upon the second request to please do not smoke. Some form of pressure could be taken.
There are cartons on a violation. Is it intent required? I don't think it is, no.
Well, I think intent would have to be required because, or it could be stated along with the word violation, that if someone intentionally smokes, because it's very easy for a smoker to just light up a cigarette non-thinkingly. And he should not be penalized for the habit so much. He should, there should be a penalty if it does not comply with the non-smoking regulation in defense of non-smokers.
Pat, have you obtained any legal advice as to whether or not various bodies of the state, not including cities, and I think there's no doubt that a city could adopt an ordinance, certainly, prohibiting smoking in areas such as you mentioned here. And if that ordinance were in effect, then certainly they could prohibit it without question. But have you actually checked to determine whether this committee, for example, while we might say no smoking and have Sergeant Armstrong did smoke, in the absence of legislation, have you checked to find if there'd be anything that would in fact make it a violation of law if we said you couldn't smoke, or the highway commission said they couldn't smoke, or some other subdivision of the state? And what I'm saying is, I assume, perhaps incorrectly, that all local bodies or subdivisions of government could prohibit smoking if they chose. Now, that may be an erroneous assumption. Have you checked that to determine whether or not legislation would be required to clearly give to a committee of the legislature, for example, the right to prohibit smoking in a building?
No, I have not checked that out. And I really question whether that is a valid point, Vern, in that here we are discussing not necessarily aesthetics or philosophies or even rights, the individual's rights. The individual's rights is based on his cooperation with the total unit. And it's not just a matter of being a non-smoker and feeling offended by it. This is not a tempest move, preventive promotion. We are concerned with health of people, the physical and mental health of people. And that is paramount to aesthetics and philosophy. And legislatively, we can pass such a bill like this because it has to do with the well-being of Oregonians. It is not a prohibitive measure. If we are requiring democratic processes where the public has to set and attempt to follow what is going on governmentally, if we are asking them to join with us in making decisions, we have to be responsible to, number one, their well-being physically and mentally. And because we are in an enclosed environment, poor ventilation, very poor ventilation, for example, in this building, the Capitol building, we have the duty, really, to follow up and pay attention to the fact that we have many findings, medical findings now, and I think there are some people who will follow me and testify to that fact, that physically, smoking is quite damaging.
I think the point that I'm making about that is, obviously you feel quite strongly about this matter, maybe rightly so, but the question really is, whether or not this is necessarily a matter of that has to be legislated on the state level, or whether possibly as a middle position, we should clarify the right of a subdivision of this government, the board, commission, water board, school district, etc., clarify their right to prohibit smoking at one of their regularly called public meetings. It may be that that isn't the possibility, and it would be better. I mean, I know if you had your druthers, you would have this bill passed just exactly the way it is. But if there's a question, if for some reason some of us don't feel quite as strongly as you do on that point, wouldn't it be better to have a bill that clearly authorizes each board, commission, subdivision of state or local government to prohibit smoking during the course of a public meeting on a unilateral basis than to have no law at all?
No, not necessarily.
Are you talking about whether legally we can do this or not?
Yes, the thing that comes to my mind, we just assume that by a vote of this committee that we can say to no one's phone.
No, I don't think that's an appropriate question for.
Well, I think it's
why appropriate
question. Well, because it relates to the on a compromise basis as to whether or not you can, whether or not a local body can legislate.
Senator Cook, could you please, within the next few days, assign your committee clerk to please contact Dr. Chris or someone in the health department, state health department, and ask them that opinion. I would like a reply to that, say within the next 5 days, if it's possible, from your committee. But if that were the case, I still feel that this kind of a companion bill is necessary for implementation. You leave it up to local government, like we've left many things up to local government, and things don't get done. And we are talking about people's lungs and their breathing ability. So I think that we should take responsibility and extend jurisdiction in this area.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we've got
maybe I should bill here.
we've been cut down 1 hour. We've got witnesses here. Several other things on this bill. I just don't want the committee to go into a discussion on the legality of the bill. Representative Whiting is going to be able to answer that.
Well, this is the point I wanted to make on that. With our
administrative
assistant obtain a legal opinion as to whether or not local units of the state government have the authority, and the boards and commissions have the authority to prohibit smoking at any meeting which they are conducting.
We'll do so. We can do it without actual Attorney General's opinion.
Mr. Chairman,
well, I don't know why we shouldn't ask the Attorney General.
Because we're not going to pay for it.
Mr. Chairman, that the last session of the legislature passed House Bill 1811, which is 441515, which prohibits smoking by any visitor to a hospital in any room in that hospital which has more than one patient. And every senator in this committee voted for it.
So to get back to my friend on the issue, that's fine, if you don't mind. Okay.
House Bill 1811.
Now, all the other witnesses on Senate Bill 508 have indicated the length of the testimony is going to be very brief. And I would like to take into consideration what's already been testified to and try not to be repetitious. To Mabel Schiffer.
Schiffer.
I'm Mabel Schiffer, Executive Director of the Willamette TB and Respiratory Disease Association. The primary concern of our association is respiratory health. Air pollution and cigarette smoking are major dangers in respiratory health. Tobacco smoke represents a pollution hazard to non-smokers in a closed room with smokers. Among the air pollutants inflicted on both the smoker and non-smoker are particulates, carbon monoxide, tar, nicotine, isoprene, nitrogen oxides, nitric oxide, ammonia, acetone, and cadmium. Persons already suffering from respiratory diseases are particularly susceptible to damage from tobacco smoke. Dr. Thomas Goddard of St. Francis Hospital in Hartford has testified that inhaling smoke from other people's cigarettes, cigars, and pipes can actually be fatal to asthma and emphysema sufferers. A significant number of non-smokers experience discomfort and respiratory symptoms on exposure to tobacco smoke. Some eye irritation is experienced by 70% of the non-smokers, according to one study. Thus, allowing smoking at public meetings effectively bans participation by that portion of the population unable to tolerate smoke. Precedents for banning smoking within meetings do exist. The American College of Chest Physicians has agreed that no smoking be allowed at their meetings in small rooms, and a special section be set aside for smokers in larger rooms. In fact, they support smoke-free areas for non-smokers in all public indoor facilities. Our National Tuberculosis and Respiratory Disease Association has voluntarily eliminated tobacco smoking at any board and committee meetings in view of its long-standing commitment to the elimination of smoking and because of the need to protect the non-smoker. Passage of Senate Bill 508 will be an important step toward protecting the health of the non-smoker. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Senator Carson.
Okay, well, approach this bill, say, is to work, go into the quicksand, frankly, of a public meeting. We spent the last 3 weeks on a, called an open hearing bill or whatever it is. And I sympathize with the passing bill trying to draw from a public meeting. Are you aware of any other states moving in this direction, or do you have any recommendations to see about whether we'd be better off designing the room and we get a hospital room as opposed to the patient and try to go after a public meeting room rather than define what a public meeting is? If you really get in a deep trouble.
We might be. It might be the first step. Bill Stevenson mentioned, he felt this was not all-encompassing, and it was not maybe encompassing enough, but it would be the first step, and perhaps we could move on from there.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you. I have a copy.
Is Mr. Quasim here on 508?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Cecil Quessett. I'm an attorney here in Salem and the attorney for the Mid-Willamette Valley Air Pollution Authority. Michael Roach, the director, had a conflict in his schedule, could not be here, and he is prepared now to present to you his statement involving and his thoughts involving Senate Bill 508. I, by the way, have prepared copies of his statement, which I'll be pleased to distribute to the committee. The authority is concerned with interior ventilation problems and air pollution in enclosed public places. The air contaminants created by man's activities in these places are nearly the same, if not identical, to those air contaminants found in the surrounding or ambient air. Air pollution authorities in Oregon and generally in the rest of the United States do not have control or jurisdiction over air quality in enclosed places. However, there are a few agencies in the United States, such as Suffolk County, New York, that are beginning to develop standards and guidelines for air quality within areas open to the public, such as auditoriums, indoor athletic facilities, catering establishments, and so forth. Undoubtedly, there is a need to develop guidelines for ventilation or to prohibit certain polluting activities in such areas to protect the general public. As our knowledge becomes more refined on the adverse effect of such pollutants on the human population, we become more concerned. Ambient air standards have been promulgated by the federal government for various pollutants and subsequently are required to be adopted by state and local air pollution agencies. These standards are based upon what science has thus far been able to tell us of the obvious as well as the insidious effects of air pollution upon man and his environment. Standards must be set to protect against identifiable effects upon health and welfare. The standards most apropos to smoking tobacco would be those for carbon monoxide and for particulate or smoke. The standard for carbon monoxide is 10 milligrams per cubic meter of air, approximately 8-hour average, or about 9 parts of carbon monoxide in 1 million parts of air. The standard for particulate is 0.15 milligrams per cubic meter of air over a 24-hour concentration period. If a person was subjected to particulate matter for less than 24 hours, allowable concentration could increase without adverse effects. Luckily, most meetings do not last 24 hours. If these standards are applied to a normal conference room of 5,000 cubic feet with minimal ventilation, a brief calculation would show the following. One, two or three cigarettes per hour would exceed the particulate standard. Two, six or seven cigarettes during the meeting would exceed the carbon monoxide standard. These calculations are based upon the value determined experimentally that 1 pound of emissions are generated for every 1,000 cigarettes. If the volume of the room is doubled, the number of cigarettes allowed to meet the standards would be doubled, etc. Even if the standards were not exceeded, the nuisance conditions of smarting eyes and second-person smoke inhalation should have some value. Control of smoke in enclosed or public meeting places would be similar to control of air pollutants to the atmosphere and could take a variety of forms and approaches. A value and viable approach is to prohibit or limit activity creating the pollutant as proposed by Senate Bill 508. The authority supports the adoption of Senate Bill 508 as a beginning in addressing the problem of air quality in interior spaces.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
One question. I want to make sure. Did I understand correctly that if there are three cigarettes smoked inside this room, that they would exceed the standards?
Two or three cigarettes per hour would exceed the particular standard according to Mr. Roach's calculations here.
On carbon monoxide?
On carbon monoxide, yes. I have copies of your statements here for you.
Betty O'Brien, here to testify the bill.
I am Betty O'Brien, Information Director for Willamette TB and Respiratory Disease Association. Our association is concerned with protecting the right of the non-smoker to breathe clean, healthful air. Even healthy persons completely free from respiratory problems are adversely affected by exposure to secondhand cigarette smoke. I won't repeat the specifics that you've already heard, but I would like to note that the effects of exposure to carbon monoxide can include altered auditory discrimination, visual impairment, psychomotor impairment, and increased errors in choice. I believe that a non-smoker should be able to attend a public meeting without being subjected to breathing carbon monoxide and other cigarette pollutants. To quote an attorney, Anthony Roisman, the right to be free from tobacco smoke is a higher right, a right which restricts the far lesser right of the smoker. When the two conflict, such as in a restaurant, on an airplane, in a museum, the smoker must give way and must bow to the superior right of the non-smoker to be free from smoke. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you.
Yeah.
Kenneth Ross.
Senator Burns and members of the committee, I'm Kenneth Ross, Executive Director of the Oregon Tuberculosis and Respiratory Disease Association. My testimony will be exceedingly brief. I believe the clerk has given you a copy of the one-page resolution on smoking.
Yes, we have that.
And so that's just about it. I'm also representing the Coalition for Clean Air Oregon Washington, and testimony has been given that the level of carbon monoxide attained in experiments using rooms filled with tobacco smoke has been shown to equal and exceed the legal limits of maximum air pollution. And therefore, because of the adverse effects of human health and well-being, the Coalition for Clean Air Oregon Washington is in favor and supports Senate Bill 508. Now, for the Oregon TB Association, our medical section, the Oregon Thoracic Society, has joined with us in recognizing the non-smoker's right to breathe clean air, and whereas it's now known to have harmful effects on the smoker as well as the non-smoker, and we've documented that in the U.S. Surgeon General's 1972 report on smoking and health. And therefore, at the meeting on December 8, 1972, the Oregon TB Association declared its official commitment to the concept of non-smokers' rights and established a non-smoking policy at all official association functions and directed that this policy be announced by the presiding officer at the beginning of each function. In conclusion, the Oregon-Washington Coalition on Clean Air and the Oregon TB and Respiratory Disease Association respect your request, your respectful consideration of Senate Bill 508.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Any questions? Thank you.
Chairman.
Senator Jernigan.
Just to bring this thing into focus, this previous testimony on 5,000 cubic feet and 7 cigarettes would be 67 would exceed the carbon monoxide standards. That would be a room 10 by 20 by 25.
Thank you, Senator Jersey.
Your Honor.
Elaine, is it Rustad?
I wanted to.
I think
that 5,000 cubic feet is a room 10 by 20 by 25.
I am representing the many thousands of workers in places that are suffering from lung diseases, coughs, discomfort. I have been working at the labor industry building right across from here, and I invited many people that could come with me this morning, but they couldn't make it because they had to work. But they told me too that I would represent them. That's what I'm here, representing many, many of them. I was working there for about 6 months. Within those 6 months, the first couple of weeks, I was sort of on one side. And then they changed around tables like this, you know. And we had three smokers, chain smokers, in front of me. I'm not here to, because the smokers have right also, so have we. And I don't mind if they smoke, if they have their own place of smoking. But when they're sitting right in front of you all day, 8 hours smoking, and my eyes was tearing, my throat and my nose and even my stomach, I could even taste the stuff. So I was very much in discomfort, so I mentioned it to my supervisor. Not a minute of complaint about them, because they're just a fine bunch of people, but it was my discomfort. I mentioned that the smoke was bothering me, that it was nothing they could do about it. So Mr. Anning, which was the supervisor, said to me, Elaine, it's nothing that I could do at the moment. I said, well, why? I said, because I need a rule from higher authority. He says, it bothers me too, even though I do not work there. He had his own office on one side. And but when I go around, he says, it bothers my nose and my throat. I says, that's why I'm not around there too much. Well, anyway, it was bothering me so that about many times, about 3 o'clock, I said, Mr. Anning, I says, I just feel like I want to throw up. He says, Elaine, why don't you go home? You get paid for it. He understood my discomfort, but yet it's nothing that I could do about the smoking here. I said, I'm waiting for the higher authority. I said, well, with God's help, we're going to try to find some higher authority. So I did call I wrote to Governor McCall, and then I wrote to him. But at that moment, he says, I can't see anyone because there was government this legislature, now he was too busy. He says, but after the legislature time, I will be able to have time to speak to you. So anyway, it was my discomfort was so bad that I couldn't take it anymore because I had to go home. My throat was so sore. And in my lunch hour, I go out walking on the outside, and I feel a little bit, but as soon as I get there, but the thing is that these ladies that are smoking say they couldn't stop smoking. But when we were doing the filing, you know, filing away, sometimes we were filing for 3 or 4 hours steady. They didn't have to have one cigarette. They didn't even miss it. But as long as they sat on their desk, they started to smoke, you know. And as I said, the only thing that we are pleading is that if they only have an area in this building that they will have the smoking, that is fine, but not in everybody's face all day long.
You spell your last name R-U-S-T-A-N-E?
Right.
Okay, your first name is Elaine, and what agency do you work with?
I work for the tax department at the Labor Industry Building.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Wall?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Your name is G. Wall?
Ernest G. Wall.
And you live in Texas?
Yes.
Thank you.
For 7 years, I was the administrator and teacher in the school district here in Marion County and also in Mill City. And I finally came to the conclusion that the best way for me to get away from the problem of smoking was just to get out of the educational system because as an administrator, I had to attend board meetings. And every time I went through one of these sessions, I would come away with a terrific headache. And the same way, if I were to go in the teacher's lounge or at the conventions that we were required to attend. Now at the present time, I'm the administrator of Haven Acres, which we deal with retarded children. And many occasions in the past, I've gone to conventions and to meetings in relation to the interests of retarded children, and I've run into the same problem. And after hearing all this discussion, I can see now why the headache results this is the way it affects me. But I used to attend quite a few of these conventions and meetings, but I get so that I do not attend them anymore because of the way it affects me. And so I have to send one of my assistants to attend these meetings. And I feel, as a citizen who is required to attend these meetings in order to continue the interest of the business that I'm in, that I have a right to be in a place and not smell the smoke. And I appreciate the fact that I'm in a room here this morning where I'm free from this tobacco smoke. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wall. Oh, you have a question?
No, I want to ask for clarification, Pat, again, and just remind me of it. How about a teacher's meeting in the schoolhouse? Would that come under this?
I do think so, because it would not be a governmental meeting. It would be educational, but maybe because of this testimony, and I do not, I was not aware of who was testifying, according as to what degree. And it's the point, educationally. Maybe because the educational system also comes under the protection of Oregon as a state agency, then educational facilities should be included. That is not recreation. People have to be in attendance mandatorily in education. So I would
concur
with the gentleman's request.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Paul. Gertrude O'Reilly.
I'm here this morning to represent my son and my daughter that both work for state. That both of them work for state. One works in the Labor and Industry Building where Lane has worked, and my boy works for state engineers.
You're from Arlington, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
and they are unable to attend this morning, so they would like to have me come and speak for them. And my daughter has a sinus problem, and in her office they have quite a bit of cigarette smoking there that really bothers her, and she comes home with a headache a lot at night. And my boy is a draftsman, and he said it really dulls his brain to have all that blue smoke in there all the time. And
does he work for the state also?
Right. Mm-hmm.
What agency do they work for?
Well, she works in the hearings department. He works for state engineers. He's a draftsman.
Hearings department where?
In the engineering.
Engineering. Do you have a question?
And he would like to have you really consider this seriously, to have another room for them to smoke in. He said he respects their smoking, that they want to smoke, but he still thinks it would be great to have them have a room of their own to go so they don't have to breathe this. And he has opened the doors lots of times for fresh air, and it creates a draft, which we know isn't good, but that's the only way you can really get along sometimes. He said it's so blue in there. So he, pardon me, go ahead. So he would like to have you really give complete consideration, serious consideration about this. And see
if you
can.
We will.
Okay, thank you very
thank
much.
You Frank Baker.
Frank Baker, the Director of Health Education for the Seventh-day Adventist Church for all of Oregon, and the coordinator for the five-day plan to help people stop smoking, which is a community service feature of our church. Several years ago, we didn't realize the relationship that smokers have to non-smokers. But in the last two or three years, as we've begun to accumulate evidence, and I have access to a research service, which gives me about 100 or more file cards a month in this area, we begin to realize this. For about 12 years, I have been giving instruction to young people in school concerning the hazards of smoking. And they would say, of course, if we don't smoke, we're all right. I used to say this until about 3 years ago. And now we notice increasing studies on the effects of smokers on non-smokers. And in our five-day plan right across the state of Oregon, we notice that these people who stop smoking and get over it, now when they're exposed back to the smoker, they notice these hazards. And it bothers their throat. It troubles their breathing. And they didn't realize this before because they were smoking. Dr. Herbert Savelle of the University of Vermont Medical Center said that many people are as allergic to tobacco smoke as others are to ragweed and other grasses. Eyes, throat, nose, and lungs can make the allergic person a sniffing, weeping, wheezing example of misery. 8 people out of 100 are allergic to cigarette smoke. In another survey, Dr. Frank Lemon of the University Medical School at Loma Linda says, though smokers had a higher level of CO, the amount in the blood of non-smokers in a smoke-laden room was substantial and sufficient to be detrimental. In a random survey in Los Angeles, 20% more children had respiratory problems when they were exposed to smoke. In Detroit, a similar survey showed 39% more had such trouble if they came from smokers' homes. And Dr. Richard Walden from the University Medical School at Loma Linda says that breathing secondhand smoke causes electrocardiographic changes. Evidently, the non-smoker's heart is not immune to the effects of tobacco. And due to the increasing evidence we're seeing on this, as we talk to many people who have stopped, and as I talk in schools, probably last year giving over 150 lectures in various schools, on the effects of smoking, we realize that there is a strong carryover damage now to the non-smoker, and we plead his rights for fresh air. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. That concludes the hearing this morning on Senate Bill 508. Now, we will not have another hearing unless proponents feel that there are areas we haven't covered. If you do so, I would request to submit anything in writing. If you feel that you need to have further testimony, let me know. And the other consideration will be if we happen to find a witness to oppose this bill, they'll have an opportunity to testify. We will have a work session, and possibility of amendments. Maybe a week to be ready for work session. Senator Meeks, Senator Carson, and Dean will work on this. He's going to check for that bill we had before to see if there are any legal opinions. He'll be ready to connect with that. He'll find out if he'll be ready on whose behalf the bill was sponsored. There's nothing there. We'll ask the city council to give us an opinion on the question for Senator Copeland.
Chair, my present feeling is that I'd be amenable to supporting a bill that would give the authority to the local government bodies to do what is anticipated here in case there's an inspection. And I think also, and probably personally, just one attitude, I'm kind of speaking as a witness against it, perfect sense. I'd also be willing to fairly give to the person having the responsibility in a publicly owned facility such as over here in the Labor Industry Building to, if it were necessary, for decent tranquility. That working facility to prohibit something, and I personally would be willing to give, if in case there's any doubt about it, give to the school board the authority to prohibit the use of tobacco on school grounds.
Chairman,
would it be appropriate for this committee to draft a rule change that we can look at the same time
for our committee
regarding smoking in this committee?
Certainly.
And then we can have a chat. Of course, after we get there, when we get better knowledge, we can call.
I will. You want to draft a rule and submit it for your consideration. All right. That concludes the hearing on Senate Bill 508.
I wonder, Mr. Chairman, if Dean could also arrange to have drafted an amendment along the lines that I've just suggested to this bill, irrespective of the
Well, that's fine. That's fine. Okay. Now, let's have that. If we put this back on work session a week from now, I'm going to do it all. Right? Can you do that? Put it on a work session. Pardon me? Oh, for okay. The meeting after that would be about getting it.
We have it proposed then.
Right, a week from then too. Mr. Bateson, we got a problem.
Sure.
No, come on up with Steve. What we'll do about it. So, on 3/17, we have two witnesses other than yourself on that. On 3/18, you're the only witness. On 3/21, you're the only witness. Apparently, just on 3/17, there are other witnesses. So there's somebody on 3/23 and 3/17. Your preference is to take these in the order we have them up there.
Yes, but if your committee would prefer, we can start with 17, with 3/17. However, whatever the pleasure of the chair.
Well, point is, on some of these, apparently you're going to be the only witness.
That's correct.
And then we can schedule it with you available at another time. I suggested that perhaps we could come back here after the session, but there are 11 items on the third meeting calendar in the Senate, and it may be unrealistic to try that today. So if it works out all right for you, why don't we go to 3/17?
Very well, Mr.
Chairman. Maybe we can handle that this morning. I don't know.
May I make this comment, sir? I don't. The fact that I am the only witness on these other bills does not, in my mind, indicate that they are unimportant.
No,
they are they're critical, and I'm sure the committee feels
the same way. Scheduling problem is important, so you don't have to come back again.
Who are you working for now?
Health now.
Exactly.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Cornelius Bates, and I am the administrator of the State Health Division. The Health Division has a broad number of responsibilities and in many cases does not have the authority to carry them out effectively. One of the areas so involved is the area of mobile homes, tourist facilities, trailer parks, recreational parks. Now at the present time, the law states that the health division shall make regulations concerning these various activities, all of which are in Chapter 446, and that the local health officer shall carry them out. And as a matter of fact, they haven't been carried out. The job has not been done accurately. It's not been done in a credible manner. We've done some survey work, and we find from that that is our estimate that in statewide, probably less than 30% of these facilities governed by this chapter comply with the division rules. In one county, we found 70% that did not comply. Now, the only authority that exists in the present statute is to get the local district attorney to take action under criminal penalties. The practice and the fact, and I'm not maligning DAs when I say this, has been that they don't. That's, after all, not exactly as important as an armed robbery or the other things with which our very overburdened district attorneys are faced. So the proposal of this bill is to put the authority to make the inspections and to do the licensing on these facilities at the same place that the law has had the authority, has placed the authority for many years to make the rules about what constitutes a safe, sanitary, proper mobile home park or tourist facility. Now, at the present, so it's primarily a matter of uniformity of application. Now, the bill does another thing. It takes the first steps toward making this program self-supporting. This particular program has not been self-supporting out of license fees in the past. It also adds a new variety of camp called organizational camp to the group of things that are covered. And I'll get to that in detail when I get into it. Now, if I may draw your attention then to the bill, and I'll be speaking here in terms of what the amendments do. The amendments on page 2, lines 11 through 22, are the key amendments to the moving of the authority for the inspection and licensing of these camps from the county to the state. And may I remind you again that we're dealing with a situation in which the state has already had for many years the authority to make the rules about them. This will now move the licensing and inspection and enforcement authority to the state. The change at page 2, line 28, parked to located, is just something that needs to be done. There was a state Supreme Court decision, the case of Astoria against Northwang, 1960, came down, which held that a trailer, once you take the wheels off the mobile home, it's no longer parked. Located it is, parked it is not. So this change is simply to contemplate that. It has no other, this change has no other function. On page 3, at lines 28 and 32, again, we have simply the transfer from the health officer to the administrator. On page 4 is a matter over which you will get some static, I'm sure, from the industry. This set of proposed fee changes will provide approximately 50% of the money necessary to support the program. At the present time, the old schedule supplied them 25 to 30% of the amount of money necessary. It's our view that this program should move towards self-support. However, we didn't feel that it was fair to make the jump all in one shot, in one session.
Go all the way,
about double those figures.
Here?
Yes. But we felt that these increases are substantial. These increases, by the way, are identical with those which were considered by the last legislature in a bill which was later either tabled or expired at the end of the session, but not over the issue of the fees. So the last legislature also had proposed and looked at this situation.
Why do you think it shouldn't go all the way? I don't see if you got an operation of any substance at all, why they couldn't be advised that they wouldn't even notice it. Most of them.
They will make an argument to you, which I think has some merit, that in the smaller ones it does make a difference. And in the smaller mobile home parks, that the jump from $10 to $100, which is the proposal, if I understand, that you're suggesting, would be sufficiently substantial to cause them quite a bit of economic stress. So this is the reason that we chose, when putting the bill together, to put it in at this fee level, which we think is fair. This is an annual fee. Now, at this point, there is an amendment, purely through oversight. On line 13 of page 4, we have, for each picnic park, the fee is $15.
We, just a pure matter of oversight, forgot to put in for organizational camps, which will also be $15. And I have prepared amendments to propose to the committee in that respect.
Why, really, on the same point, this is a profitable enterprise. Why in the world should the public bear the burden of keeping them up to standard? Why shouldn't those who are in the business pay the cost?
We believe in the long run they should. Simply, this is purely legislative decision. This is our suggestion. So what
would you mind finding me a committee with a schedule that would really do it now?
You can simply double those numbers and it will do it. No, I'm being quite direct with you, Senator Cook.
Would that be the fairest way to do it? Now, would you do it, would you just double it right straight through, or would you do a little different, would you do it a little different way than you have it?
There are, as there is in any kind of a money-raising scheme such as this, a myriad of assortments we could use. We could either make a high base in small increments, or we could hit the larger ones, the ones over 100, extremely hard. Doubling is a way to do it. Another way to do it would be to increase the base fee, for instance, the up to 25, very substantially, because there are a very large number in this category.
What would be the fairest way in terms of the benefit-burden ratio?
I think the fairest way would be simply to double them. Right now, if you're at the top of any one of these brackets, you are paying $1 per space per year. That would make that the top of the bracket would be $2 per space per year, except for those over 100, where it'd be only half of that amount. If that is what the, if it's the committee's pleasure to double those fees, then I would suggest that is probably the fairest way in which to accomplish it.
Mr. Bates, I'm assuming that there are annual inspections.
The inspections under this bill will be twice annually, every 6 months.
What is the situation currently?
Situation currently is that many of them simply are not inspected. We have records of trailer parks that have not been inspected since 1962 by the health officer charged with the authority to do so.
And there have been mobile homes in and out of the park?
Yes, sir. Now, we are not inspecting the mobile home itself. This inspection goes to the park.
The septic
facility? A myriad of things. The spacing, the fact that there has to be a concrete pad, a parking pad, the amount of play area that's involved, all the things that go toward making it a safe and sanitary place to live. Now, may I point out that this also goes to hotels, motels, such things as that. We're dealing with approximately 3,000 such facilities in the state. 1,895 of them are in the class hotel, motel, sleeping cabin, that kind. 997 are mobile home parks, 170 are recreation parks.
Gordon, talk about having organizational...
The phrase is organizational camp, and if I may, sir, if I defer that, because I'll get to what an organizational camp is, it's later in the bill. Now, the amendments on page...
Senator Carr, excuse me, Gordon. If this comes to pass, how many inspections would the state of Oregon be making? Do you collect all the inspections in one? In other words, if we put the authority in the health division, can you just make one inspection and do all the things that have to be done by the state government and inspect the same process?
Well, as to these agencies, this is the only thing that does need to be done by the state government. Now, there are other bills involved. Senate Bill 318 deals with restaurants. And there is no reason that if you're going to a hotel, for example, or a motel with a restaurant, that the two inspections couldn't be done at the same time by the same individual. It will vary somewhat with the particular training and expertise of the individual. But in those counties that have, as many do, good, well-trained sanitarians, under the contract arrangement that we would make with such a county that was properly staffed, there's no reason he couldn't do it and do the restaurant and the hotel motel at the same time. However, most of these, you don't have the double license. They've got one kind of ticket or another. The change on the amendments on page 4 at lines 18 and again at 28 and at 29, excuse me, 28 and 9, are again to change health officer to administrator. I'd like to point out a change at line 32, where we put in the word suspend. and then delete a substantial portion running the latter part of page 4 and the top of page 5. That language is an old substitute for 183, the Administrative Procedures Act. Before 183 was passed, statute after statute had its own variety of suspension revocation procedures. We simply want to go straight to 183 in the normal manner so that, like every other license, it's treated the same way. The change at page 5, line 6 implements that. The changes in section 6 of the bill, again, this is the transfer of authority. Now, in section 7, we are going to a biennial inspection because we think that that is what is indicated. A proposal has been made by the Mobile Home Association, and I don't know if they'll make it to you, but they did in conference with us, that if a mobile home park has a clean ticket for a couple of years and there have been no violations, that the frequency of the inspection could be reduced. They made this point to me on the basis that it would reduce the overall costs of the program and perhaps not necessitate a fee increase. I would point out, Senator Cook, that their proposal, their objection there was to the fees in the bill, not the proposal that you have made.
Now, do you think, to work out some kind of an experience with motels so that the fee could be reduced?
I think it would be. However, I would suggest that since we're talking here about the license fee, which also includes the inspection, we'd have to face another problem. Do you want a lower price for the outfit that is doing well and doesn't need to be inspected, or do we simply lower the total of the license fees because some of them don't need as many inspections? And that's another philosophical point. However, it would take at least 2 years to determine any organizational experience on this. And so I submit that that is a question that reasonably could be left to the next legislature as far as movement in the fee schedule is concerned because of good experience. We simply don't know enough about it yet because here, up till now, we've had no inspection authority in the health division. A new procedure, a new language, starting at line 25 of page 5, is to deal with seasonal facilities. Where a regular park, for example, would be inspected every 6 months on a scheduled basis, you don't know, or the health officer in the health division can't know when some of these vacation parks are going to close or open up. So we simply ask for advance notice for the seasonal facility so we can get out and make the inspection beforehand.
Senator Carson. Is this the part where you also inspect the state, county, and city prayer areas and so on? You have that authority?
We will do that. We will be doing that. Farm labor camps are also in Chapter 446. This chapter has four chunks. This does not affect farm labor camps. As a matter of fact, Senate Bill 44, the Occupational Safety Bill, which has passed the Senate already, repeals all language in the Oregon statutes relating to farm labor camps. They're just treated like any other camp. So this change would not affect farm labor camps without respect to what else the legislature may do. This is not a labor camp bill at all.
What do you mean by the repeal? You mean after that bill is passed, there will be nothing regulating farm labor camps?
There will be nothing special regulating farm labor camps. They'll be regulated like any other place of employment. They'll be under the Occupational Safety and Health Act.
There will be nothing relating to the standard of the health standards?
Yes, sir, there will be, but it'll be the same things that relate to the health standards in other places of employment, the timber camps, in any other place in which employees stay at the convenience of their employer.
I see. So what you're saying is there is other legislation on occupational safety would relate to the housing provided,
yes, it will,
to employees.
Yes.
Would it be substantially equivalent to what is provided on other residential facilities under this act?
No, it would be quite different. This act deals only, this deals with rental, with transient rental accommodations. And I suggest that the two are simply not, they are not similar. For example, a room in the Hilton Hotel doesn't qualify for farm labor camp right now. It's designed for an entirely different purpose. It's not designed for long-term occupancy. So it's apples and oranges. And this part of Chapter 446 dealing with these facilities is completely separate and distinct from the farm labor section.
You say transient, so this does apply to mobile homes, many of which not really banned.
This applies to the parks in which they are placed, not to the homes themselves.
Whether it's a mobile park, whether it's tailored on a more or less permanent basis.
That's correct. It applies in both cases. It applies in both cases. The long-term one, where they're brought in two halves and put together and may never be moved, as well as the one where you bring it in and stay a couple, 3 days, perhaps, or a month and move on. The changes in Section 8 are routine funding fund account changes and are required for this transfer of authority. On page 6, line 17, we're just picking up a piece of the 1971, the thing that was missed in 71. Plumbing was changed from the Health Division of the old Board of Health over to the Department of Commerce, and this reference simply needs to be brought into position. Page 6, lines 22 through 31, where we want to work on the area of the play areas, the problem of play areas, and we want to have an exemption for an organized or special play area where the spaces run 4,000 square feet or greater. And this would then, by the new language starting at line 29, allow the larger mobile home parks, the more spacious ones, to be relieved of the responsibility of providing a separate play area if their spaces are minimum of 4,000 square feet.
For each unit?
For each unit.
Chairman,
going back to the Department of Commerce, that means then that there'd be another inspection, right, besides yours?
Yes, sir, just if you were building one. No, these are the construction inspections.
Okay.
When you're building a house, for example, you have a plumbing inspection and electrical inspection and so on. That would also be true in the construction of these. That's a general statute not related to the annual maintenance or semi-annual maintenance inspections that are talked about here.
What do we do about an apartment house when it comes to play areas?
I'm not aware that there's anything in the statutes about apartment houses in play areas. The statutes, with the exception of this landlord-tenant bill that's been proposed here, I've never seen anything in the legislature that really went to the regulation of long-term living facilities.
But we're doing that this
time. No, sir. I submit that these are not long-term living facilities. They're essentially short-term. We're facing a real problem in mobile home parks. If we take them out of this control, they will be under no control. Now, I have been meeting with the industry on this, and I have proposed to them that we played with this and tried to get some wording. We couldn't do it. I proposed to them that prior to the next legislature, we try to find a reasonable description of these good mobile home parks, the spacious ones, you know, that are really more like residential areas, and move them toward the Uniform Building Code and Planning and Zoning as the regulatory agency, and get them out of this type of thing. But if we simply remove references to mobile homes here, that means there's no control over a lot of places that you and I would both agree got to be looked at, of these almost 1,000 mobile home parks. There are some very good ones. Our problem is defining the good ones from the bummers, or from the good ones from the ones that need tighter control.
The only concern I have here is that we're, again, doing the thing that we've done time and again, taking the mobile home and segregating it and saying, okay, now you have to do certain things, but other housing we don't have to. Residential areas, things of this nature, we're not telling them to provide play space.
Well, may I suggest, Senator Meeker, that this bill, the proposal that's here before you, is designed to make it easier for them, not to make it harder. The law presently requires the play space. We want to remove one of the problems they have in these large lot areas and make life easier for them.
I just concerns me that there is a discrepancy difference.
Concerns me too, and this is why we're going to be meeting with the industry to try to solve that problem. We have agreed, however, that there's no way we can do it in time for reasonable action by this legislature, partly because of the Uniform Building Code bill, which seems to be progressing, Senate Bill 43. If that goes through, then 73?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That then may offer the vehicle, if you'll pardon the phrase, for solving the mobile home problem. Well, I'm not sure whether it will. It's not possible to do it in this session because of the integration of the bills. If I may proceed, Mr. Chairman, the changes in Section 10 deal solely with the authority change, changing division to administrator, health officer to administrator. On page 8, the changes at lines 3 and 6, again, required for this transfer of authority. Page 8, lines 10 through 13, there is a change of substance. At the present time, if a person wants to put up any non-prefabricated structure in a mobile home park, he must get authority either from the health officer or, if there is a county zoning and building inspection officer, from that person. This would change it so that he would have to get approval from both the health division and from a local building and zoning officer if there is one. The reason is that the health division is not in the planning and zoning business, and I do not think should be in the planning and zoning business. If we leave it in the alternative, it means that someone could come up and get permission from me and thumb his nose at the local planning and zoning authorities, and we want to avoid that possibility arising.
Senator Cardin, why does the health department have any interest in whether or not a prefabricated building or a non-prefabricated building is put up? What's the rationale? I realize it's a law.
The rationale is that if they're going to put up a laundry house or they're going to put up a garbage storage house, which is for their dumpster or something like that, I'm sure there are cases in which you could have a structure that has absolutely no relation to health. But I can't think of it. Virtually everything that would be built in a trailer park, non-prefab, but built, is going to be related to it, to this. If I can draw your attention back to the rather extensive definitions of carport, ramada, awning, cabana on page 3. These were all assigned to health when this bill was written. I think most of the work on this was done in 63. It was a big revamp in this whole area. And because of that, the law put this authority on either health or planning and zoning. Now, because it's being moved from local health to division, I don't believe the division should be put in a point where it is an alternative to local planning and zoning compliance.
I agree. Yeah. Of course, I was mildly concerned as to why you ought to be involved at all.
Because frequently those are related to the health and sanitation, these structures. Be related to the health and sanitation of the people who live there. It's customary in many of these mobile home parks to furnish centralized laundry facilities, bathing facilities, such things as that. Particularly the older ones. Now, the big new parks, no, you don't have that. But the older ones, it's quite common. The next change on page 9, starting at line 17, the conspicuously post the notice. The policy operation on this has been that we've printed in super large size type fancy weatherproof copies of these rules so some guy could nail them up in the park. And we think that's a waste of time and the public's money. We'll still make copies of the rules available in mimeograph form or in pamphlet form. But we don't believe that it's necessary to require conspicuous posting in the mobile home park of all of the law and the rules that are involved with it. On page 9, at lines 26 and 27, we're back into the transfer situation again.
Now, could I back off?
Yes.
Hasn't this had a salutary effect so that the tenants there would have a knowledge of what the rules and laws were?
We believe that it is a non-productive expenditure of public money. We don't believe that there is any advantage to it, to having it there. This is a highly competitive field now, and it is a field in which, with state regulation, we do not believe it's as necessary to post the law so the citizen can find out if he's getting a fair shake. We will have inspected the place to find out if it is clean and safe. And remember, we're talking here about the health and safety statute. The reason that the definitions appear again in Section 13 again illustrates the way Chapter 446 is broken up. We're now in the area dealing with recreation parks, camps, such things as that. And now we're at the question of organizational camp. For many years, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, Campfire, Wise have come to us and said, hey, will you go up and check out our camp, make sure that it's safe before the kids go in there for the summer. And we've done this. It's been a non-statutory thing. There's been a courtesy. Sometimes they come to the health division. Sometimes they go to the local health officer. Now, we've run into one very serious and documented case over on the coast where such an organization running a camp didn't have adequate sanitation, they didn't have screening, they didn't have cooks, they didn't have life-saving gear. It was just a miserable shambles. So we believe that it is time that these camps be brought under some inspection control. And this then is the definition of an organizational camp. The question that you raised earlier, Senator Burns. And it includes all of these, which are the auspices of a religious, public, private educational system, or community service organization.
Corey, you bring them under up there under subsection 1, section 42. It seems like some extent to take it back out again.
In section 15, and that is the reason that I have an extensive amendment to propose to section 15, in part to solve the point you have just raised, and also to deal with the thing that has arisen in eastern Oregon since this bill was printed.
What's that?
A thing called Laramie West. It's a land holding scheme which allows a tremendous recreational camp to be put in without any control.
It's on a fossil.
Is it around fossil? It's on the Little Deschutes. Well, we do too. We've got a doctor out there now. It is. I like it. Now,
there's this organization camp, but you have the same standards applied to, let's say, Boy Scout camps. I can think of a few traditional ones that you would have on, let's say, a church organization where mostly older people would go. Would you have the same standards applied to both camps?
I believe that we would. I would see no reason to change them. We're talking about standards that deal with the water supply, with septic, with sewage disposal, with the food preparation areas.
Well,
pure sanitation type things.
I can see quite a difference between the Boy Scout camp and food preparation. I could an older group of older people represent the church organization. Food preparation.
May I ask which you think would be the stricter?
I think the older people.
The requirements for the kitchen should be stricter in such a case than they would be in a scout camp?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, there may not be a
kitchen. May not even be a kitchen. Yeah.
We only get into it if there is. We don't say you have to have one. We simply say that if you have one, it has to meet these standards.
Where is the kitchen going? What?
In the regs. You get a copy of the camp regs.
Oh, they're in the regs.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Oh, you see,
No, Mr. Chairman, members of the
committee. This was, I think, I have the same concern as Senator Gerson. It wasn't applied to a fireplace where employees didn't cook over.
No. It applies to the things that the camp provides for them. Now, if the camp doesn't provide centralized cooking facilities, then we aren't going to say you must have them. We're simply saying that if you do have centralized cooking facilities and food storage facilities, you've got to have meet reasonable standards of sanitation.
What if they don't provide a toilet?
They must provide a, this is an exception to what I said, they must provide a proper method of sewage disposal. Either a pit privy, septic tank, whatever situation they want, but one that is in accordance with our rules. And by the way, privies are perfectly satisfactory in those camps for short-term use. Like those of you who, yeah, those of you who have been to Heart Mountain may be interested that we got a request to whether those little beehives were legal. The answer is, yep, they are, for short-term usage. Now, the change that we would urge being made on
football camps that are run by high school coaches or college coaches, that wouldn't seem to fit under, certainly not a private education athletic.
That would be an athletic camp.
Yeah, but you.
I don't agree that.
You reach it up the top. You talk about that's what prompted me. The athletic camp must be under the guidance, supervision.
I don't agree, sir. May I parse the sentence in the way we read it?
Okay.
An organizational camp is all areas designated by a landowner for recreational use. It includes, but is not limited to A, youth camps, B, scout camps, C, summer camps, D, day camps, E, nature camps, F, survival camps, H, athletic camps, I, camps which are operated and maintained under the guidance and supervision of. We don't take that closing phrase to modify or control the list of camps, but instead to be another, be the last thing in the list.
Okay. Where is this list?
On page 10, starting at line 5.
Okay. Nature camps.
Yes, nature camps. Actually, I think they call themselves nature camps, but that would also could also be a thing such as OMSI's operation. Now, whether OMSI wants to get in the nudist business is their business.
Mr. Chairman, who's going to inspect the nudist camp?
We're talking about an interim committee. We always welcome legislative surveillance of the division's activities. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have an amendment to the area starting on Recreation Park, which is very complex in the amendment form, but which I have prepared hand-engrossed copies, if I may hand them up to the committee. I think it'll make it easier to follow. And we propose to delete the reference on page 10 at lines 10 through 12 and substitute this language for it. Now this is where we get into what I call the Laramie West problem, and I think we use that as a tagline. In this area, on the Little Deschutes, the landowner proposes the following, and he's got this cleared through real estate, there's nothing they can do about it. He sells memberships in this organization to people. As one of the concomitants of that membership, they have a right to the use of a specific and designated part of that land, all of which is platted out, though not filed. It's community septic tank, community dump tank type operation. So it isn't a septic tank. We can't get hold of it that way. But they have the right to use this in perpetuity, to alienate it, to bequeath it, really virtually all the incidents of ownership. But there is not a sale. Therefore, it is not subject to the control of the subdivision statute. Since they do not contemplate individual sewage facilities, septic tank facilities, and they also don't warn the buyers that there's no way they could get away with that on lots of that size, there's no sanitation control at that level. For this reason, we believe that we have to get some generalized sanitation control and surveillance in such an area, and for that reason have proposed this definition of recreation park, which, as you can see, is somewhat broader and deals with the rights of tenancy that are involved. Now, such a recreation park, then, would be subject to certification under this bill.
This would be in lieu of the present section 4.
Yes, effectively it is in lieu of that. Apparently their contention is to have a large community holding tank. They're anticipating largely trailers. Do they have any septic tanks in that plan, Brian?
Yeah.
They had some
trailer dump stations going to septic tanks.
But they didn't have any individual toilet facilities particularly.
No.
So they were contemplating primarily trailer use, recreation trailer use. Yes, it would, but that's not the only use that could be made of it. It could also be used for camping. Somebody could come up and put up a privy, or...
And there is no facility for that kind of thing now.
There is no facility for that now, and there is no control over it. There is nobody who looks at it and says this is safe and sanitary or is unsafe. This would, we believe, give us this certification control over these things for an annual fee of $15, which is the proposal for the amendment we made on the earlier page.
Does somebody want to use this amendment so we get it attached to the bill?
I have the proper amendment form here, properly drafted, by the way.
You've got a different form of amendment what we got in front of you?
No, sir. What I have is the proper amendment form, which accomplishes what you have in front of you.
Right.
This is drawn up the way LCC would draft it.
Does anybody have any objections to that?
Okay.
Now, maybe we can
put it in. Now, Senator Burns, you pointed out quite accurately that it looked like one section put organizational camps in and then down in Section 15 took them out. We agree. We therefore ask the committee to delete Section 15 from the bill, not to repeal 446.325, but to delete it from the bill. And this amendment form, which I've handed up, also contemplates that.
Do we need any further action in order to delete it, or is that in this amendment?
That is in that amendment there. It is, I wouldn't want to mislead you. What is here is on that page, but other material is also on that page, and I have flagged each of them for you as we came along.
I gather your motion was to do.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, so we urge that Section 15 be deleted. The changes on page 11 are to take care of the transfer of jurisdiction, also to get the phrase organizational camp in at lines 15 and 16. The changes on page 12 of the bill have two functions. One is to delete some penalties which are for sections that were repealed by the 1971 legislature, and also to make a funding change. So the deletions that occur in the lower part of page 12 are statutes which have already been repealed by a previous legislature, and we have to take that language out of the statutes. This bill does have an emergency clause for July 1 effective date because of the license year problem.
I have many questions. What do the repealers repeal?
Do you have that?
List of repealers, sir.
022 and 08.
One is being reviewed. What was done on the line? And then Bill 44 repealing all farm land.
This is a situation in which a... That's the one that's in on that other bill.
It's 022. It's proration.
Under 022, it allows the buying half a license, a quarter of a license, or three quarters of a license, where you can buy truck tags. That's being repealed. 082 is a section which states that none of this about traveler's accommodations applies to a city that has and enforces its own standard of sanitation for mobile home parks and travelers' accommodations. We believe that if there's to be uniformity, it must literally be uniformity, and that we shouldn't have separate control by each city of its own sanitation for mobile home parks.
Is that true of septic systems inside the city?
No, sir. A general state law states that all septic tanks, and the law as it now exists, all septic tanks must be in accordance with the division's rules.
Be in accordance with what?
With the rules of the health division. Administrative procedure rules.
Are you inspecting these items in the city of Portland?
No, sir, because the inspection, the concept of inspection on septic tanks doesn't come out of the health codes. For some reason, it has historically lain in Chapter 215, subdivision. And if there is to be inspection of a septic tank or the granting of a permit, it's done under the Chapter 215 authorities, which are not health statutes at all. We do certify or register the people who put the tanks in, and under the law, you can put it in yourself or you can hire somebody, but you may only hire a licensed person to do it, or registered.
Are there some cities, perhaps counties, in the state that are really effective jobs
of septic tank control?
Generally, what this bill translates to
I would not like to say that there is no city or county that is doing it adequately, but I do not believe that it can be said that all cities and counties are doing it adequately, and this section would leave it to the choice of that city or county whether or not to assert it is doing it adequately.
It would give it a what?
It would give it the right simply to assert that it's doing it adequately, and by making the assertion, remove itself from the state uniformity.
If you decide that.
We would not have the right to decide whether they are or not. Under 082, as it now exists, if the city of XYZ says, we're now going to take that over and we'll do it, they're simply saying so, gives them the authority, and they take it from us.
Suppose they take it over and you allow the job.
That's the same reason we want to repeal that section. It would allow them to take it over and do a lousy job if they chose to do so.
You are going to make the decision. Well, under this, you're going to do it all.
That's correct. Or contract for it being done. We will contract with county
sanitary. How many increase the budget that I have to ask for?
Well, our state budget will not have to be increased because under the proposal, and this is a contracting section that's in 2336, we will receive the money. And then we will contract with counties to perform the inspections.
With what?
With the county health departments to perform the inspections. And then we will pay them when the inspections are done. Right?
You're not planning on having the manpower to do this yourself.
We don't plan to increase the state employment roles to do this. I plan to contract with local health operations and then to supervise them and make sure it's done.
Okay, is that in the bill?
No, sir, that's in Senate Bill 2336, because that concept applies not only to 317, but also to 318.
Is that mandatory that you contract?
No, it permits the contract, but the emergency board will make sure that it's mandatory by saying if you don't contract, you better contract because you don't get the new positions to do it yourself. And I wouldn't ask for it.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you,
now,
sir.
Here's what we're doing. I want to apologize to all the
members.
Change the time of the session to be this morning was decided at the end of yesterday's session. We put our notices out so that we'll have adequate notice of these meetings about 10 days in advance. And the reason was the ways and means committee going on a trip today, and the session was moved up so they can attend the session. We're going to put the rest of the bill on the agenda. We're going to put it back on the agenda for March 27th at 8 o'clock in the morning. 317 will be number one. We'll proceed to the other bills thereafter. 423 will not be on that day. So that day's session will be solely on these four bills. And I would gather
we can
handle the 2 hours, you think?
I hope so, but I thought we could handle this one in 25 minutes, too. So.
I thought we could handle the full view about 30 minutes.
That's a week from Tuesday, the 27th.
Pardon me?
27th.
Yes, that's Tuesday, March 27th, 8 a.m. I want to apologize that wasn't some of the meeting that I know, but there it got beyond our control as of about 11:30 yesterday morning. So that concludes the hearing now. Same agenda on March 17th on these four bills. Sorry, I can't hear you.